All right, we're back on Bluegrass Bios. This is WLXL LPFM Lexington Community Radio on 95.7. We are in the lower level of STEAM Academy on East 6th Street. We're happy to have in two guests today. One of them is a regular. Say hi, everybody, to Dr. Alex Estrada. And Alex, you say hi back now.
Hey, everybody. Good to be back. Good to see everybody.
And a guest to talk about his organization, Spencer Mancius. He's of the Kentucky Equal Justice Center. He's the AmeriCorps Financial Literacy Specialist. So we're going to get into who he is and what that organization does and what his responsibilities are there. How are you doing today, Spencer?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Fantastic. So they're a nonprofit poverty law advocacy center, and they're associated with or the umbrella of nonprofit of the Maxwell Street Legal Clinic, a source of high quality, low cost legal assistance for immigrants and refugees. So it's sort of becoming a theme show. We just had the people in from the Kentucky Refugee Ministries in here. Maybe you could tell me starting off, like what it is that Kentucky Equal Justice Center does.
Well, like you said, we're a nonprofit poverty law advocacy center. What that means is we do a lot of public interest advocacy work, being a consumer watchdog. And we also do things like giving workers' rights presentations and putting on our wage claim clinics every month for individuals who aren't getting overtime or getting all their appropriate wages. And then we also have a healthcare outreach branch that does getting people signed up for healthcare, making sure people are aware of their options, and advocating in the healthcare arena as well. And then we have the Maxwell Street Legal Clinic, which is the our low-cost immigration law firm.
What's a circumstance where someone would need to put in a wage claim?
Well, like I said, anywhere where they're working and they finished a job or something, and then they look at their paycheck, and it's a lot smaller than it should be, or whether that's they're not getting what the rate of pay that they were promised, or getting their overtime pay, or anything like that.
Are these from, is it mostly, like, smaller businesses that would try to pull something like that?
Yeah, generally, it's you'd find a lot in, like, painting or doing just housework or things like that, so... It's usually smaller claims that we deal with.
Okay.
So do you guys also deal with like undocumented workers and things like that, helping them with their work situations also? Because I would assume that segment of the population might be more at risk to getting taken advantage of.
Yeah, exactly. So oftentimes, everybody in our office really speaks Spanish. So we do a lot of work with undocumented immigrants who, like you said, people think that because they're undocumented that they don't have to pay them. However, the way that the law is written is anybody who's an employee is supposed to get paid for their work, whether regardless of their immigration status. It's actually on the employer to find out their immigration status before they hire them, whether or not that happens. Mm-hmm. And then get paid.
And that mainly came out of 9/11, right? With all checking the immigration status?
I think it
may have always been on the books, but maybe
it became more enforcing of it. So, sure. Or they were supposed to be.
You're an attorney.
I am, although I don't practice in my capacity for the Equal Justice Center.
So what do you do in your capacity for the Equal Justice Center?
Well, I give a lot of community outreach. I do a lot of presentations on workers' rights, and I help run our wage claim clinics, and just do a lot of really getting out in the community and seeing what the needs are for our populations that we serve.
And how does AmeriCorps fit into that?
I'm funded through AmeriCorps. Okay. So AmeriCorps pays for my position to serve at the Equal Justice Center. So I'm not officially an employee of the Equal Justice Center. I'm serving there as an AmeriCorps member.
Okay. What are some of these, what do you guys cover at the workers' rights seminars?
Everything from minimum wage to your basic rights, like how Kentucky is an at-will state, so you can be fired for anything, but you can also quit for any reason. Also, making sure that people are aware of like OSHA regulations, discriminatory firing. Obviously, that's illegal. And then making sure people are aware that they have options of workman's comp or anything in that regard, I guess.
How often are your seminars?
Whenever an organization asks for them, we generally do, I'd say about two every month is our going rate. But any organization that would like us to give in a presentation, we're more than happy to help.
And for more information, they can go to kyequaljustice.org.
Yep. Yep.
That would be where to start. You can also follow them at kyequaljustice on Twitter. All right. So maybe you could explain to us what the legal clinic does.
Well, our legal clinic it's a low cost, it's immigration and refugee families. So we do a lot of like DACA cases, and we also just do regular citizenship cases. We do temporary protected status, U and T visas, Violence Against Women Act, green card renewals, work permit replacements, family petitions, help people get their travel documents in place.
What is DACA, if we can just go back a little bit?
Yeah, DACA is Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, and it was put in place by an executive order by President Obama. And what it said is basically, if you've been living here, I can't remember the exact dates, I think it was since after 2006 or something, for a certain amount of time, then you're an undocumented individual, then the government will basically acknowledge that you're undocumented, but defer prosecution of you.
Right.
So they're not going to come down on you. They're not going to deport you. They know where you're at and everything. So if the law changes, then maybe there'd be some worries there. But it also allows you to get a work permit and basically just sort of live worry-free for 2 years.
So it sounds like it's essentially helping out this undocumented person, which is being a contributive member to society as compared to some other people, which may have some nefarious intent to kind of, you know.
Yeah. Right. So. Yeah. Well, it's prioritizing, sure, from what it seems like. There are a lot. There are a lot of stipulations for age, like you said. You know, you'd have to have them right in front of you to read off. But it's like, you know, if you're under 31, or you were you were under 16 years old when you came to the U.S., you have to be in school or graduated or have an honorable discharge from the military. And it's basically, I mean, it makes sense to me, right? If you just got brought over here, you know what I mean? Like, because you're with your parents, whatever it is, then, it's funny. We were actually talking about, we went into the weeds on wet foot, dry foot before you came in here today.
Oh, okay.
We had
flashback. What was that? The first show, I think.
That was, yeah. That, right? I mean, and it's sort of a similar thing, right? Like, if you're undocumented, you know, you still should have the opportunity to contribute, not just for them, but for society as a whole.
It's a back and forth, right?
Yeah.
Make it a win-win for everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why do you do this work, Spencer? Why do you find this important?
Well, I come from a family of my grandparents were immigrants, so it's very near.
Where did they immigrate from?
Mexico.
Okay.
I'm half Mexican. I know I don't look like it, but so it's near and dear to my heart. I know the struggle that people have coming to this country and trying to fit into a new place where, I mean, most but everybody doesn't speak their language, and trying to, I guess, preserve their culture while still being able to assimilate and work and live in a new country. And I'd like to make that as easy as possible for as many people as I can.
Is that one of the more prevalent nationalities you see at your
place? It is. Yep. I mean, we're globetrotters. We serve people all over the globe, but we definitely have a large Mexican client base.
And the reason why I asked is because when I moved to Lexington, I'm first generation Cuban American, very very small Cuban population here, as compared to northern New Jersey and Florida, which is what I'm used to, and where there the predominant immigrant group is Cuban American. What else? What about have you seen an influx of European immigrants?
A few, I think. I don't really have all the numbers.
Yeah, I don't expect you to rattle off stats.
Yeah, but we're very anecdotal in sure. here.
I guess Yemen. Let's see, where else? Iran. I could go through the whole list. Sure, Australia, South Korea, Mexico, Uruguay, etc.
So Lexington has a diverse representation of different countries.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Okay, great.
You'll deal with refugees then, huh?
Yep, that is another clientele that we serve. I know KRM usually has a lockdown on that, but if they need our services, we're happy to help.
What defines refugees for our purposes or for your purposes?
Somebody who's escaped violence, who's gone through the refugee vetting process and has been approved and is now admitted to America as escaping a country that they need.
What are some of the, even setting aside a language barrier, but some of the challenges that you've got financial literacy specialist in your job title. Do you find that to be a pretty pretty wide gap to bridge?
Yeah, it's things as simple as opening a bank account that people just have never done before or don't know where to start. So really, it's just helping people get their bearings about them and figuring out a plan. Here's a budget. Here's how much I can save. Here's how much it's going to cost to do whatever in the future. And here's how I'm going to plan for that. So oftentimes they will come here without those resources available to them. So we try to help them out and let them know how to make it in America.
Spencer Mencius, he's the AmeriCorps Financial Literacy Specialist for the Kentucky Equal Justice Center, a nonprofit poverty law advocacy center. How many people you got working over there?
We have three full-time staff and one part-time at the Maxwell Street Legal Clinic, and then I believe we have seven additional at the Kentucky Equal Justice Center. That's our director, our healthcare outreach, our employment law attorney, and then our consumer advocate attorney, and I guess myself. And I think that's
so.
And our healthcare.
considering law is not a that's a difficult and time-consuming practice, right? How difficult is it to sort of keep everything afloat as a nonprofit,
We're very fortunate. We've actually gotten increased funding, I think, every year for the past couple of years. We are funded mostly through the United Way of the Bluegrass, and we also get some other funding from our community partners around town. And then we also receive some federal funding, although a lot of that's earmarked for certain things that, like, we can't use that to serve undocumented immigrants. So it's a challenge. I know that's a lot of that falls on our executive director, Rich Seckel. But he does a great job. I know, he's our money man, and he's always working those spreadsheets, and they look good to me.
Shout out to Rich.
Why don't you tell us more about this healthcare outreach? Because that's my realm. I'm a physician, so tell me more about that. Because I had done back in New York and New Jersey, I had done some previous charity work for undocumented persons, and a good friend of mine runs a clinic in Florida where they provide healthcare, free healthcare with volunteer workers to low-income persons and no-income persons. So why don't you tell us more about that?
Well, we do a lot of outreach as far as healthcare is concerned. We give presentations, letting people know what options they have. We also participate in like health fairs around town and help people get signed up through Connect or privately if they are undocumented. And we help, we have staff dedicated to enrolling people, and then we also have a healthcare attorney who is sort of a lobbyist in a way. We help influence policies such as helping figure out this whole Benefine Connect transition and making sure it's as simple as it can be. So really it's a lot of education and advocacy, and then we also sign people up, although we don't directly provide services in the health regard, I guess. But
interesting. Great, thanks.
Yeah.
How do some of these budget cuts affect your ability to provide or get people in touch with health care? I mean, that had to do with the Connect system, right? That losing funding.
Yeah, I mean, it's just been a sort of a mess as we, because Connect, although it had its own set of problems, it was pretty user friendly. And now that we've transitioned to Benefine, I mean, there's a 50 page memo from the Kentucky government that's detailing how you work around all these bugs that they found. So I think it's just a it's a time of transition, and transition's always hard. So
okay.
It's just a matter of figuring out how to make something user-friendly.
All right. So since you sort of specialize in the in workers' rights seminars, what are some of your other colleagues? What are their what other specialties are people taking care of over there?
Well, as I said, we have the health outreach staff, mm-hmm. which is three, one attorney, a healthcare outreach specialist, and then our like social media specialist. So we do that's our healthcare outreach staff, and then we have an employment attorney who's based out of Louisville, and she does work really statewide on making sure, sort of along with our wage claims, that people are getting everything that they're supposed to be entitled to. And then we also have our staff attorney, and then our director, and they are our sort of heads in Frankfurt who keep track of all the bills coming through the general election or general assembly, and being their watchdog role.
Let's say I do pick up a check and I see that I've been shorted a few dozen hours. What's the time frame like from filing to? I mean, is there a lawsuit that has to go on? Do people have to go to court?
That's really what we try to avoid with our clinics. Sure. Is people will come to our clinic and then we'll help them write a demand letter, basically saying, here's the law, here's what you owe me. I would like a response by this time. If I don't hear anything, then I'll proceed further. And we've had a fair number of resolutions just, you know, in a matter of weeks where they get the letter and then, oh yeah, I guess you're right, I didn't pay you, and I see that now. Whoopsies, my bad.
Yeah.
So that's always the good story, is when people get their money back. And then obviously it's sometimes people drag their feet and, oh yeah, well, you know, here's the blah, blah, blah. And then we'll I guess our second level is going to the Department of Labor and filing an official complaint with them. And then if it needs to proceed, we can talk about referring them to a private attorney or taking on the case ourselves. And that point, the process is much longer and more involved. But I want to say, hard to say a timeline for that.
Have you had like any workers' compensation injuries, accidents, stuff like that, that have been difficult for some of them?
Not that I've only been working here a year, so I haven't managed any of those cases. But
if something like that happens, you're
yep,
prepared. You've got a playbook in hand.
Yep,
for workers' compensation.
Yeah.
Would there be any So that would kind of fit in with maybe the health, the Connect, or what are we, was it Benefine?
Yeah. No. Yeah, just making sure people know if you do get injured at work, it's your employer's responsibility to have workman's comp insurance, and you're supposed to be paid as you would if you were able to work, but you couldn't because of something that happened at your job.
Spencer, I'm curious as to Ben brings up a great topic of workers' comp and whatnot, because, for example, I was involved in a case where I had a patient, make a long story short, worked at a car wash, undocumented gentleman, had his foot crushed. I fixed his foot, but when it came time to file for a workers' comp case or anything like that, the employer basically said, I don't know that guy, I've never seen that guy in my life. Mm. So how do you prove that, or I'm just curious as to how that works, because even with a wage dispute, I could see an employer saying, oh yeah, that guy never worked here, I don't know them anything.
That's one of our biggest pieces of advice in every presentation we give, is keep track of everything on your own. You might have a punch card system at work, but right when you get there, have a little notebook or something. Write down when you get in. Write where you're working.
Keep your own time card.
Yeah, it's pretty good advice, because if it comes down to a court case, all they're going to have is generally the punch card or whatever, the timesheet, right, from your employer. It's really helpful to have your own set that you can argue with. Hey, here's my hours.
Good old CYA.
What's the trickiest problem you've encountered so far?
Tell us a good case.
If you've got one, man. Or if not, maybe some. What's the easiest thing you do? What's like the?
I guess the hardest thing is just dealing with employers who think they're above the law, or who think that the law doesn't apply because somebody's an undocumented worker, and then having to explain to them, usually multiple times, that it does still apply. The actual onus is on you, and you still have to pay these people. And those conversations can go on for weeks.
Well, so much of the conversation, especially nationally, is focused on the people who are undocumented, and not for the people who are hiring them. And not paying them minimum wage, or taking taxes out of the paycheck, or stuff like that. Let's see. How can just the community in general get involved? What's a good way to volunteer, or fund, or fundraiser, or anything like that?
Well, I guess the best way would probably be, we love donations, obviously.
Where can people donate? How can we find you?
KYEqualJustice.org. There's links all over the front page to find donations. We have volunteers, whether that's you're really good at translating or really good at whatever, we might be able to find a spot for you. We're generally inundated with volunteers, but we can always use more.
He's Spencer Mancius. He's the AmeriCorps Financial Literacy Specialist at Kentucky Equal Justice Center. Do you have any other hard and fast rules, like your personal timesheet one, stuff that sort of sticks out on your bulletin? Seminars?
I mean, I think that's really the big one. Just making sure that minimum wage is changing in Lexington, so it'll be $8.20 on July 1st, so make sure that you're keeping track of that. We're actually having a community question and answer next week, Wednesday, at the Village Branch Library, if people have any questions or concerns about the minimum wage and want to know how that's going to coming to effect. And we also run our wage claim clinics every third Wednesday, so that's also next Wednesday.
All right. Any more information, you can go to KentuckyEqualJustice.org. Follow them on Facebook or Twitter at KYEqualJustice. Thanks for coming in and talking to us today, Spencer.
Oh, thanks for having me. Yeah, you too. Thank you.
All right, so we're going to go to break, and then we'll be back the entire rest of the show. Just the boys in here, me, Ben, and Dr. Alex. This is Bluegrass Bios on Lexington Community. All right, so we're back on Bluegrass Bios. This is Lexington Community Radio. We've had a couple of great guests in here today talking about local issues, but as Ben and I were discussing at the top of the show before we got into some hot Game of Thrones talk,
I've yet to see that, you know. I
just don't start. Just don't.
Yeah.
No, just do yourself a favor.
It looks interesting, you know.
It is interesting. Well, you should check
it out. And also, I mean, The Walking Dead or whatever. I haven't gotten into either.
The Walking Dead's just kind of fun. It's really goofy. But anyway. I enjoy it. But you should check it out because it may be something you're really into. And if you never watched it, you'll never know how much enjoyment you would have gotten out of it.
I just find it so difficult to sit down on a schedule and watch a program. Well, now we have DVR.
Do you binge? Do you binge watch stuff?
He's got kids. He's a doctor. There's about to be 60 hours of this show.
My binge is sleep.
You know what? You know what the thing is about this show and comparing it to The Walking Dead 2 is it has so... It's such a downer all the time that you keep watching because you think, well, God, at some point something good must happen to somebody who I like on this show. And it rarely does. Anyway, we were talking about before we started, just sort of basically the 49 dead in the mass shooting in Orlando, Florida at a nightclub. A gay nightclub, as continues to be pointed out for good reason, right? As you were saying before we came back on the air, Alex, this was a targeted attack, right?
Sure, yeah. I think it would be naive to not see the implications of this. I mean, obviously, it's a terrorism event. But it was also a targeted community, and I think some more recent data coming out is that this person actually hung out at the bar and may have been scoping the place out and whatnot. So yes, terrorism. Yes, unfortunately, this is certainly probably one of the worst hate crimes that I could think of in recent history.
Now, here's the thing that I don't know, and don't know that we will ever know, and terrorism, while I agree, I also think, that's a catch-all a lot of the times these days. I mean, the guy...
It's an easy label, I suppose.
He was Muslim, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And the claims were, and I don't remember where, does he have a video or anything out, like one of those?
No, but I think
the
911 calls where he pledged allegiance to ISIS or ISIL, whatever you want to call
them. I mean, that's the thing, right? That's just real easy to do.
Well, exactly, and it brings up the whole concept of, the whole of being a lone wolf or whatnot, or ISIS inspired and whatever, which, goes back to the old military adage that you could defeat an enemy, but you cannot defeat an ideology. So whereas this guy may have had ties, more likely than not, he didn't. And, all these guys over there have to do is inspire people to commit acts on their own, which they have.
Yeah, I mean, listening to his ex-wife, I heard an interview with her yesterday where she's saying, they got married and then he started to show more and more signs of, mm-hmm. personality disorder. She described it as bipolar, which, again, people just freely throw around, stuff from the...
There's criteria DSM.
Yeah,
there's criteria you have to meet to be labeled bipolar. But certainly, I think it's fairly easy for someone to mislead somebody, right? Get married, and then once they get married, then their true colors come out. Whether if that's mental illness or it's a manipulation thing.
Well, can you call somebody who shoots up a club mentally ill just post facto sort of evidence that there was something wrong with them?
I mean,
do you have to be mentally ill to do something like this?
That's hard.
Well, this is what the wife is saying.
Oh, okay. Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. I mean, and the whole concept of mental illness or whatnot, it's a tough call because I think that you have to be a pretty demented person to commit such a heinous act. Mm-hmm. But some people are. I mean, was Hitler mentally ill? No, he was. Mm-hmm. He was aware. He knew what he was doing, and he had a plan. He had an agenda. He was a pretty brilliant guy, and not that I'm a supporter by any means, but he certainly, in retrospect, one could say that he was a narcissist. One could say he was a sociopath, obviously. Yeah,
right.
But, when people think of the label mentally ill, that has a stigma to it.
Yeah.
So, but...
Well, yeah, I think the only difference between, you know, what it would be like a constitution and a manifesto is just sort of like, do you see the logic in it? Oftentimes, sure. You know, when you've got your, you know, it becomes sort of something that's insane or schizophrenic or however you want to put it. Only when, you know, we start associating, like, you know, he's saying, well, it was the devil that told me to do it, or sure, my dog, or space aliens, or whatever. Regardless, the same conversations are coming up again that always do, that did after Columbine, that did after Sandy Hook, you know, that do seem to come up every, unfortunately, few months. And, and I kind of sense before we came on that that as we are separated by this desk in here in the studio, we might also be ideologically apart here. So Ben, I want you to first give your reason for why you think that this could be another piece of evidence towards revisiting some Second Amendment rights.
I think people are uneasy with a lot of the terminology. When you say,
fair enough,
challenging the Second Amendment, they think, oh, you're trying to get rid of an amendment to the con- you're trying to remove a constitutional right. Or when you say gun control, it's the implication is the government coming in, knocking down your door, taking your weapons and your ammunition.
Well, the problem always seems to be it's framed in an all or nothing.
Yeah, yeah. And there are certain guns you can't have. You can't have a bazooka. You can't have a machine gun. You can't have military-grade weaponry, like the real big stuff that they're using in war.
A howitzer.
Howitzer. Well, is there a harm in putting the AR-15 on that list, because the AR-15 keeps coming up
and that's the thing. It's, I think the public has to be educated as to what the different classes of firearms are and who could get what and what is available and what defines what. Mm-hmm. So an AR-15, you know, why should an AR-15 be controlled or banned or whatever? I could get a generic. For example, Ruger. Ruger makes a ranch rifle. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's chambered in 223 and 5.56, two very common calibers. Yep. And they have their ranch gun, which has a wooden stock. And then they have the tactical version of that weapon, which is the same exact weapon. It just looks, air quotes, like a scarier gun. It looks like a more military gun. It's the same weapon. You know, you could get, you know, I got, you know, my kid has a little Ruger 22. You know, one kid likes the wooden stock, you know, mm-hmm, old-fashioned hunting look, mm-hmm, and the other one likes it to look like an AK-47. So I bought a kit, and it looks like an AK-47.
Does this apply to the AR-15?
Absolutely.
So there are guns that are just like the AR-15 that just aren't being used because they look different, or the killers prefer this style of weapon.
It's I'm not sure where.
So if you ban the AR-15, there are ten more weapons that you could get.
Exactly. If you ban the AR-15, and everybody thinks of the big scary black gun.
Yeah.
Any other weapon will do the same. It will just look different. The whole assault weapons ban, it's based on 100% based on cosmetics. You know, what the gun looks like and what, you know, does it have a collapsible stock or not? Does it have a flash hider or not? That's it. You know, so
So if I wanted to be like outlawing the AR-15, I would have to be against an entire class of weapons.
You would have to be against rifles. And mm-hmm, and how do you, you know, and this is the problem. You know, you start nitpicking.
But can you get off as many shots with a rifle in a short amount of time as you can with an AR-15?
So
and these aren't fully, rhetorical questions. No, I am asking.
Fully automatic weapons have been illegal for American citizens to own since, I believe, the 60s.
Okay.
I, as a private citizen, can own a fully automatic weapon, but mm-hmm, it's a very expensive tax that I have to pay on that weapon, and I have to go through a very extensive vetting process and register the gun, and it's few and far between for the people that own a fully automatic weapon. So that it's a non-issue. Okay. Basically, all weapons of this class are semi-automatic. Semi-automatic means every time you pull the trigger, mm-hmm. you fire a round. Mm-hmm. Military weapons, okay, or fully automatic weapons means you pull that trigger, it's going to fire until the magazine's empty.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, you know, the whole, this brings up the argument of Columbine. Okay. Mm-hmm. With pre-Columbine, there was it may have been through the assault weapons ban, there was a limit on how many cartridges, how many bullets a magazine could hold.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And the same thing happened with the Virginia Tech shooting. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, you know, yes, an AR-15, you know, can pull off 1,000 rounds a minute fully automatic. But that's the fully automatic military version. That's not available to citizens. To citizens, it's how fast you could pull the trigger. So there's no way you could get off, you know, as many rounds. Back to the issue about the magazines with Columbine or with Virginia Tech. These criminals had double digits numbers of magazines on them. So
right.
You know, could you do as much damage? No, you can't. You know, because it's just, you know, it's an issue of, you know, magazine capacity will not affect anything. Getting rid of ARs will not change anything because you could do the same with any other rifle. It's all about how.
Would it make it more difficult for somebody if you remove stuff like the AR-15 or high density?
No, because you could do the same thing with an AR-15 that you could do with a Ruger ranch gun.
Hmm.
It's how fast you could pull the trigger.
I mean, you could walk in with a revolver that holds six bullets and kill six people. You know, I don't know right. I don't know that the equipment is, and that's the part where I think that starts getting wrapped up into this conversation that I don't think is really that relevant, you know, you know, and there's another part of this too, which is, you know, sort of what comes back from the, you know, I am pro gun control, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I am not pro disarming. You know what I mean? Like,
this is where we need the public to be both educated and involved and interactive. And as we've discussed before, we need to quit it with this polarization of I'm on the left, you're on the right, I'm not listening to you. You know, mm-hmm. and you know, so gun control, that's a great term. Define it. You know, I'm very right leaning on the political spectrum.
Do you think clip size does anything?
No, it doesn't. And I can show you multiple. I can show you videos. I can show you data to substantiate that.
How about a conversation about legal access? Now, this guy
Absolutely.
Had been investigated by somebody. I think it was a federal body.
FBI yeah. investigated him twice, and both times he was cleared.
Right. Okay. You know, I have to. What do you?
It's frustrating,
right? It's almost like if I have to open up a file with your name on it, then sorry, man, we're done. You know what I mean? Like
sure.
that name got in front of there in the first place. If we're gonna start, we can go into a lot of what ifs on, you know, anytime this stuff comes up. What if there were people in there that were also armed?
Sure.
What might the outcome
I mean, there's so many rabbit holes, so many
sure.
kinds of worms that,
sure.
that we could open up with this.
You're right.
You know? You know, the whole thing with this guy being interviewed by the FBI twice and cleared. I mean, hey, we have a legal system in place. We have the best legal system in the world, right? It doesn't mean it's perfect, you know. So, you know, the whole stigmatization of someone. You know, let's say I was interviewed by the FBI because somebody mistook me for someone else. Does
sure.
that mean I'm labeled for life and I could forever, you know, not be able to buy a firearm? Have to be on a no-fly list and whatnot. So I mean, it's a very sensitive area. My personal take on this whole thing, and it's not political at all. It's not theological at all. I think it's very practical. Bottom line, with the hate crime issue, the gun control issue, the terrorism issue, it is a fundamental lack of respect for fellow human beings. That is the root cause. Because, you know, one could be of a different religion, one could be of a different sexual orientation, one could be of a different ethnicity, whatever. It doesn't give anyone the right to harm the other individual in any manner. So I think that is the fundamental root cause.
Okay, well, does that go back to theology then? Because I think we could open up medieval books that would suggest that that respect for your human beings is not something that we are great at as a species, right?
Like, I mean, we're not. I mean, we're not very different, you know, conceptually, you know, from monkeys, right? One monkey has a banana, the other monkey wants a banana, punches him in the face, takes a banana, right?
Right.
But we would like to think that we are better than monkeys, and we do have a conscience, or we do have more of a a choice, of a thought process, and I think it's. It transcends history. I mean, if we're going to be humans and we're going to be a smarter species, again, using the air quotes, okay, bottom line, if, you know, Kyle or Ben, if we differ politically in political views, if we have the color of our skin is different,
whatever lifestyle,
it doesn't give me the right to harm you in any way. May that be, you know, financial, physical, you know, whatever it is. You know, we need to respect each other.
So do we then come back to mental illness? Because, you know, as you said, you know, maybe this guy was hiding his true colors. But correct me if I'm wrong. Some of these disorders, this brain function disorders, can come about in the early mid-20s, right? This stuff can sort of crop up.
They can. But
I mean, we'll never know.
Right. Well, you know, like, you know, for example, you know, you'll have someone, you know, someone that's obviously demented and is not thinking clearly.
They need to be intervened with, I guess.
Sure. Whose shoulders does that rest upon? I don't know. How do you identify these people? How do you, you know, is it up to the primary care doctor? What about people who never see a doctor? It's very difficult. I mean, there's no magic bullet, no pun intended.
Well, you know, there was one of the positive headlines I saw, and I mean, if you go on to the New York Times website right now, or really any major news outlet, it's just that. You know what I mean? You might be able to find the NBA Finals five scrolls down the page. But one of the headlines that I read was that a shopkeeper turned him away when he was trying to purchase military-grade body armor. Did you see that?
I did not see that.
So I didn't read the article again, but you know, that would be, to me, you know, kind of one of the points, right? If you are, you know, it's like with the Virginia Tech, as you mentioned earlier. I remember one of the stories that came out from that. That guy was going to an outdoor shooting range, setting targets on the ground, and then just shooting them point blank. And the owner or manager of the gun range only came out and said that later. Well, how about you get on the blower as soon as you see that, you know what I mean?
Sure, but how many of us out there haven't had an interaction with law enforcement where they just kind of, you know, they don't want to be bothered. They have bigger things to worry about.
And it does kind of beg the question, how many people are doing that, and do you call the cops on all of them?
Yes, exactly. I say yes. If you see somebody laying...
We have this guy. The FBI came down in question at least twice, yeah. And now the FBI is on TV saying, well, we couldn't have done anything differently.
I mean,
we didn't do anything wrong.
I've competed in three-gun matches. So for those of you out there who don't know what that is, three-gun matches... It's competitive shooting. It's very safe. It's increasing in popularity. And you have a handgun, a shotgun, and a rifle. And there are targets at different places. Some targets are on the floor. Some targets are, you know, way down range. Some targets are closer. So if someone goes to a gun range, they're placing targets all over the place.
Lays it on its back?
I don't know, Kyle. I didn't read this. But my issue with that is, well, what about a guy that's just not practicing?
Okay, you know? Well, I
don't know.
I got to go back to your statement then. Where does the diligence happen? You know, not everyone, even if you're going to see, you know, you want to talk about the police being busy. How about your general practitioner? You know what I mean? Doing clinic hours.
Exactly. So, I mean, it's... With the whole mental illness issue, I mean, I think it's if someone the database has to be reporting needs to be mandated, and I think it's getting better. And I believe the Affordable Care Act has something in there to address that. But the police, the FBI Nixus system, NCIS, I think it stands for National Criminal Something. I forget what it is, but basically anyone in the country who wants to buy a weapon, needs to clear that. And that conceptually has, local and federal, law enforcement records, as well as now has mental health records, but not every mental health patient is being placed into that list. Why, how that process works, I don't know. You know, but that's certainly something to look into. But this guy in Orlando had no mental health record.
Right.
You know, so
it's what kind do?
You know, what do? You ban AR-15s. Fantastic. Great. We ban them. What about, you know, the millions that are already out there? Mm-hmm. So define gun, you know, I think we as a society need to define what gun control is. Make it
as difficult as possible for people to do what happened in Orlando over the weekend.
Well, okay.
That would be the definition. And if we don't, then the debate's going to change.
I agree.
Should we ban the AR-15?
Does this just mean a waiting period? Or?
To guns becoming overall illegal.
Right.
If this keeps happening and it reaches more and more people who love somebody who's been killed by a crazy person with a gun,
society's
not going to put up with it much longer.
What about a crazy person with a baseball bat? And I'm not being snarky. The number one weapon used in violent crime to kill people per FBI statistics is a baseball bat. Okay? If you look at the chart, it's I forgot how many times more common for a person to be bludgeoned to death with a baseball bat than with a gun. The thing is, these are low frequency, and I know it doesn't seem like it, but these are low frequency, high impact events.
Right.
Versus high frequency, low impact events. So it's easy for a mass shooting to get on the news. Am I saying nothing needs to be done? Am I denying that there's a problem? No, I'm not. But by no means. You know, okay. But I mean, we could talk. I mean, we're low on time already. We could talk about any one of these, you know, rabbit holes that you could go down with this general broad topic of gun control.
But it is far easier to kill somebody with a baseball bat than it is a gun. And I guess we should have should have started off. This is the point where we say our opinions don't necessarily reflect those of management of the station.
Definitely, definitely in my case. But I mean, obviously, you know,
in a crime of passion, much easier to commit with a firearm than with an implement.
Can you kill 50 people in one night with a baseball bat? Probably not.
No.
You know, but it goes back to the concept of, you know, low frequency, high impact as well, you know. So, I mean, there was, last year, there was...
There's really no avenue to background check people who want to use blunt instruments, whether it's a crowbar or a baseball bat or a kitchen knife, to kill somebody.
Last year,
but
30 people were
killed.
There's
literally nothing you can do about that.
Right.
But with guns, there are things you can do about that.
Sure.
And you can have universal background checks. And gun show loopholes. Get no fully automatic. You have to pull the trigger. Just make it as difficult. Make it as difficult. Then go even lower with the magazine clips. Just make it as hard as you can for these people to kill either one person or 50.
And that's fine. For example, in one of the northeastern states, okay, you could only buy one pack of bullets at a time. Okay,
right.
What's to stop me from going and buying one pack of bullets
from
every store or once a week or whatever. You know,
I'm just not making it easy. The difference is one is easy,
it's
difficult.
It's gonna happen anyway.
One is you have to plan so far in advance. You have to find out which stores you're going to. You have to understand the frequency with which you can buy from each one of those stores. You have to use cash. You have to show up in person. Maybe wear a hat and sunglasses. You have to come up with an extraordinarily complicated plan.
You understand
plan
that
to
the
do
Second
that,
Amendment
as
does
opposed
not
to just walking
exist
in a store
only
and buying.
For the purpose of self defense and hunting, right? Like
the Second Amendment has nothing to do with hunting, right? Second Amendment.
Right to bear arms. Right to bear arms. Right. But the spirit behind it
was militia.
Anti-tyrannical.
Yeah.
Okay, and then you...
Do you feel like we're safe from that?
But here we go, opening up another can of worms.
Sure.
You know, Second Amendment. You know, what defines, and I quote, a well-organized militia? What defines that? You know, well-organized by whom? By a government entity? Well, that defeats the purpose. Well-organized by, you know, it's and that's another whole other Second Amendment argument, you know? So it's just, this could go into so many directions.
Speaking personally, I would like to see legislators and on a national, local, and state level start taking this issue a little bit more seriously than they are, which goes beyond drafting one bill, trying to get it through Congress, which has no chance, and then giving up.
Would you argue?
And speak out more.
Exactly.
And say, and just keep it in the front of, you know, keep it in the front of people's vision, as opposed to letting it fade away over 3 months or 4 months, and then this happens again, and then it comes back. Keep it in the public's consciousness.
Sure. I mean, bottom line,
stay out there
saying
it's unacceptable.
We need both sides of the aisle to come together and have a dialogue. And
do you think one side of the aisle is concerned about gun control at all?
I think one side
is not concerned about gun control in the least.
That's the problem, is it keeps getting framed that way.
It's all about narrative construction. I mean, there's a narrative being constructed.
Are there any Republicans who are in favor of any kind of gun control?
Yes.
Yes, there are.
Absolutely. They're being very quiet. Because can you name one?
You know, I cannot name one off the top of my head, but I know there are, and I'm just drawing
I don't mean to put you on the spot with that, because that's not very fair. But they're not exactly yelling from the mountaintops, because they'll get primaried.
Concur for the most. I think Rand Paul had somewhat of a logical, you know, approach to it. You know, but again, it comes back to the whole polarization issue. You know, the left wants, you know, or at least they're portrayed as wanting, you know, all or nothing. And the right is portrayed as, you know, pry them away from my, you know, cold hands, you know, which is also absurd. You know, I find
when you talk to, you know, real people, the citizenry, conservatives and liberal, they're far more willing to compromise on things and do things that are totally common sense.
And that's why, you know, I'll say it to a moon in the face. There has to be compromise. There has to be dialogue. There has to be, you know, back and forth.
And I'll say, as long as there's no compromise isn't on the table, and one side says every time there's a mass shooting, now's not the time to talk about it. If there isn't a compromise, then it will become an all or nothing proposition, and the right to own a gun may very well disappear, sure, as if it, like a virus, keeps spreading out. If you're pro Second Amendment, which I'm assuming you are, and you're in favor of universal background checks and common sense stuff, then I would encourage the leaders in Washington or in Frankfurt who are very pro Second Amendment to be willing to compromise a little bit, because those days may be disappearing.
We've evolved as a society since, you know, 1776. And so has technology. So certainly arms are different than they were. That's what I mean. So, you know, but, you know, bottom line, I mean, it's all about a dialogue and about compromise. You know, for example, everyone knows that I'm a passionate Second Amendment guy. Okay. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you know, just like everybody, you drive a car. Before you drove a car, you have to go to driver's ed. Everybody that wants to own a gun should have a gun license, and it literally is. It's a license.
Yeah.
Where you're trained.
The vetting you were talking about.
And make that, you know, there are a lot of things.
And the argument that I hear so often is, well, no amount of gun control will get rid of all the deaths caused by guns in the country. So why bother having any gun control is not an argument I'm interested in hearing more.
I think
I know that's not you.
It would be naive to believe that something has to be done. You know,
So people on my side of the aisle need to understand, get rid of the AR-15. That doesn't stop fully automatic.
Exactly.
We need to get a little bit more educated. And I'm glad I asked that question, because I don't know too much about guns off the top of my head.
We should go shooting sometime. I may do that.
Because what I know about guns is what, you know, when something like this happens on the news.
Sure.
So, yeah.
Well, I'd be glad to teach you the NRA safety course, and it's quick and it's easy, and I'd be glad to take you shooting.
Yeah, we may do that.
Sure.
That'd be fun.
It's a blast.
What you got, Kyle?
Governor from your neck of the woods, Republican, pro-gun control.
Oh, Christie?
Mm-hmm.
Well, see, with Christie, New Jersey is one of the strictest states in the country as far as gun control is concerned, so he kind of has to be.
Yeah.
But off the record, and when he was a presidential candidate, he really loosened his views on gun control. He didn't do a complete 180, you know, but then again, does this allude back to what Ben was saying about towing the party line,
right,
and falling in step, you know, with the party?
For sure.
You know, with New Jersey, and we could leave this for another show, New Jersey, I could go through the process behind getting a gun in New Jersey, and I think Ben would like it, as compared to Kentucky, where all you have to do is have a driver's license, a pulse, and a clean record, and you can go buy a gun. You know, New Jersey and Kentucky are the two polar opposites as far as how rigorous it is to be able to purchase a firearm.
We could go on.
It's
but I guess we gotta. It's past that time to go.
Yeah. We will pick it up another time. Hopefully, it'll be more academic than timely. For Bluegrass Bios on 95.7 WLXL Lexington Community Radio, I'm Kyle, Ben, and Alex. We'll see you next week.